I'm Nell Frizzell, and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I'm sitting in a wood talking to you about this week's guest, Daisy Buchanan. I've loved her writing for years and known her for almost as long. Her latest book, Insatiable, A Love Story for Hungry Girls, is gorgeous. The reason I wanted to talk to Daisy for this podcast is because she's one of those rare and brilliant people who's not only incredibly emotionally honest and warm and generous, but she's also very thoughtful and analytical about her life and the decisions she's made along the way. I talked to Daisy about the decision to be child-free, the emotional intensity of supermarkets, and her apparently insatiable love of lamb. So strap in and enjoy the ride. And please stick around till after the interview, where I'll be digging into some of the issues I've discussed with Daisy in a little bit more detail. Thank you. How are you? And how is your body?
I'm about 3 and a bit weeks into a whole 30, which means it is 4 weeks to the day since I last had a delicious alcoholic drink. So I'm feeling very, very non-toxic, I suppose.
Do you feel better for it?
Yeah, I've been doing lots of mad wellness things in that way of, well, you know, anything's worth a punch. If it works, it works. So every morning, most mornings, let's be real, I try to get up and have a cold shower.
That's my girl.
Because of Wim Hof. I have mixed feelings about Wim Hof, but I figure, well, it's free, or rather, I don't really have to do anything other than be very uncomfortable for about 3 minutes. I've had my fancy pants CBD oil. I've had some mango. I'm having a herbal tea. So
this is insane. This is,
when I think of, you know, my main panic years would have been like hungover, opening one eye, staring at a phone, just making lots of like Al Pacino noises first thing in the morning. Going, this is horrible. And now I'm pretty buzzing.
I feel like I'm talking to a sort of elfin sprite. It's incredible. Cold water, by the way, is the secret to everlasting happiness. That's my view on things. So stick with that.
Because I know you're big wild swimmer, and I live by the sea, and I look at the sea and I think about going in. I've not been in for a little while.
Between you and me, I'm scared of the sea. It's full of weird stuff. It's full of big, sort of greasy, smelly, bulbous creatures. So I'm a bit funny about the sea, but I love swimming in cold water. Everyone says anecdotally that it's what keeps you healthy and happy. But I think even if it doesn't, it just forces you to get up and get outside. And I think nothing bad ever happened outside to me. It's always worth going.
That's a lovely way to live. And I do, as I've been raised a Catholic, and I still believe that like a lot of the things that I do, sort of, not punishments exactly, but things I can look forward to the end of. So I can't remember if it's a frog or a toad, which amphibian it is, but Mark Twain's eat a live frog, I think, first thing in the morning, and that's the worst thing that's going to happen to you all day. That's my cold shower.
I sort of say that my panic years were largely from sort of 28 to 32, where it just felt like my entire life was set on fire in front of my very eyes. And I thought that that was a sort of personal crisis. And I now realise it was a reckoning with all sorts of systematic, important factors that you have to confront in order to grow up. But I'm interested, when you say that you had your panic years, what did they look like? When were we talking about? What are you wearing?
Lot of very short, very cheap Primark dresses, things that show my knickers when I sneeze.
With a weird Peter Pan collar. Was it that era?
Yes, yes. A little bit of that. Or sometimes really like a sort of sweetheart neckline, and I've got to, you know, arrange one tit on top of the other to get it in there. the terrible, terrible fabric.
A really flammable era.
Very flammable era. And one where, as well, everywhere I went, I had a massive bag and constant shoulder ache because I was always changing into high heels that I couldn't walk in. At that point, I was like, no, I'm a grown-up lady. This is what grown-up ladies do. And I always had grubby flip-flops or like horrible sort of mucky Converse. And I was always like bending down and changing my shoes. And my main memory is just always being quite drunk in Soho in the dark, like being with a gang of people, bending down to sort of change my shoes and giving up on the high heels and looking at, where did everyone go? Which end of Old Compton Street am I on?
How old were you when you were running around showing your knickers and changing into your grubby flip-flops, do you think?
Well, I suppose, so to give it a bit of a, I don't know, context or whatever. So I think maybe I had panic years without knowing about them, or there was sort of things being in a state of chaos, but I went from really embracing the chaos and thinking that was what my life was supposed to be. But hold on, this might be forever and I'm not up for that.
I remember you writing pieces where I would read them and just think, yes, she's absolutely nailed something that I have been wanting to express for years and years. Thank God she's done it. And thinking you were really brave. I remember you writing a piece about being a people pleaser in bed and just thinking, I wish I had the self-assurance that Daisy has that I could write about this, because I'm equally, like, you know, doing cartwheels in a smock trying to get someone to love me.
What I love about the implication of being a people pleaser in bed is that I've been some sort of, you know, delicious orgy loving. Sadly, there wasn't as much of that in my single days as I would have liked, but I was either very bored or obsessed with someone who had, you know, grown cool on me or wasn't very interested. And it just felt really, really desperately lonely. And even with my good friends, it seemed to me that everybody was in a couple. And I think at the time I didn't have the capacity or sort of resources to think, well, it's good, or rather being in a couple doesn't make you happy. So big old cliche, I know, but looking on Facebook, it's like, oh, engagements and marriages. And I really, really, in my heart, I was like, oh God, like, if you're engaged, like you'll never be unhappy again, that someone wants to be with you. I was imagining all of these relationships as being very sort of like tender and loving. And I remember going to the giant Sainsbury's near where I used to live in North Greenwich many years ago, famous among everyone who lived in that house because it never had any stock. It's got Lego Star Wars figurines and a single turkey drumstick, and that is all that is in this cavernous Sainsbury's. But going with my dear friends Ollie and Lucinda and my terrible boyfriend, and he'd been really quite, you know, mean and distant and remote, and I was very sort of pushed and pulled, I felt like we were all in a race, and Dave and Felicity were like immediately engaged, very like glossy, very, you know, we know what we're doing, we're very happy, we are not at home to self-doubt, and they were fine. Then me and my boyfriend, it was a bin fire and a train wreck, and we were like bottom of the class and failing, and I was always like on my own weeping, being stood up. And Ollie was grumpy about something and they were sort of bickering, but it was just so normal. And I was like trailing around with them like a child, going, this is what I want. This is what I want to be in.
Supermarkets are such an intense emotional space.
They really are. And still now. Yesterday, we went for a walk along the seafront, went to the local butcher's, bought a load of lamb. And I had a real like, this is everything I ever wanted. I think in a way it sounds pathetic, but you know, I own it. I've paid my bills. I've got someone to just lie on the sofa with and watch telly with. I can make a lamb stew.
Sounds like you can make several lamb stews, actually, after.
And that was when I realised maybe that my panic years were over. First, when I'd not been with Dale for very long. And owing to the vagaries of the London housing market, I thought, it's really soon, but it would be a good idea to have a conversation about moving in with him. And I was terrified, but I asked him and it was just like, yes, of course, great, how lovely, wonderful.
Did you ask if you could move in with him or if you could move in together?
I think it's because I knew my lease was coming to an end and where I lived was just horrible and I had to make a call, and he was in a one bedroom flat in Walthamstow. So moving in with him would make more sense. And I think it was sort of a, would we look for somewhere together eventually in 6 months when the other lease runs out? But it was a feeling like I could put my cards on the table, I suppose, for want of a more elegant analogy. But I remember one of my best work friends going out with someone. And I really want to say his name because we always referred to him like first name, surname, in that weird way that you do with some people.
Oh, yeah.
It had been 6 months. Yeah. And she was like, oh, I don't know. I just want to ask him if I'm his girlfriend and I want to be his girlfriend, but I'm really scared that he'll just be like, no, what are you talking about? Get out! End this now! And that awful, never being able to say like, who am I? Where do I stand? You know, do you love me? Can I love you? Am I safe? Is it okay? And getting to a point when I thought I can ask these questions. And also I know I've got the emotional core strength to cope if the answer isn't what I hope it's going to be.
Was there a moment when you thought, yes, this is what I want? Tangent while you think about the answer, but a friend once had a awards and medals party. You could bring your school certificate or your like brownie badge or whatever you'd won at some point. I remember someone bringing like a football trophy that they'd won when they were seven. And this lovely couple who were my friend's parents, they'd never got married. She was like a very radical feminist and so was he, and they're like very politically engaged, very cool. They once booked a wedding and forgot to turn up because they just didn't give a shit and they were only doing it for sort of legal reasons, and they had a pig in their garden and they were great. And I remember looking and she had just a tiny little badge that said, I belong to Jeremy. I'd be like, oh my God. This is when I was in my teens and I'm thinking, how do you get that with someone where in a completely non-proprietorial, like non-patriarchal way, just to be like, I am yours. And you are mine is almost the secondary part of that. Just that I am yours is such a magical moment. Did you ever have a moment where you thought, he is mine and I am his?
Quite early on, I mentioned this book in passing, possibly even on Twitter. And I think, because I love this sort of thing, I think it's called A Privileged Life. And it's a sort of mad, like glossy photo book about growing up in the Hamptons, never all in like vintage sort of, you know, 60s Lacoste. And we were going out for drinks and Dale said, oh, you mentioned this book and I just saw it, so I bought it for you. And I was, I think, complaining to my sister Grace, oh, he's like a stalker. What kind of a weirdo does that? Like, he calls me all the time. When he says he's going to, he plans for nice things for me. And Grace said, I think he's a nice man. And I think you've not been with one of those before. And I think this is good. And you ought to really embrace it. And then there was another time when we'd gone to see a... life sounds so good, cultured and lovely. Now all we do is watch terrible repeats of Family Guy.
And eat horrendous quantities of lamb.
That's all we do. Lamb. Five times a day. It was, what's that lovely, is it Wilton's music hall? Yeah. So in East London. And there was a musical of The Great Gatsby. And I'd got one of those like horrible sort of like stuffed up summer colds. And he just took me all the way back to Brixton, dropped me off at my doorstep, said goodnight and went all the way home to Walthamstow. I was like, this is a really decent thing to do. I was possibly quite like, well, you know, you might as well come in. You might as well stay the night. I'm a bit just like, no, you're sick. I will take you home and I will, you know, leave you to get better.
You met producer Dale and you knew that he was your person. There's a sort of expectation that you get married and then you talk about babies. Can you tell me what happened there?
Well, I think it was something that I just started to question and started to question. And I think I blurted it out. I think actually we were really drunk at a friend's wedding in America. It was a really sort of impulsive trip. It was in 2012, really soon after we'd met. It was the start of the Olympics. And I don't know if you remember, but this is a bit of a sidebar, but...
But you were on the team. You were a Team GB javelin thrower.
One arm is slightly bigger than the other. In 2012, in London, got all these emails that were like, if you want to leave your house, it's going to take about 4 hours. you know, stay indoors. It was like pandemic prep. It really was. And we thought, oh my God, it's just going to be awful.
Yeah.
There's
hordes
a wedding
of
in-
netball fans are going to like trample us in the streets. They're going to be made into sort of human pate by people wanting to get to the long jump. I do remember that feeling. Yeah.
So this wedding, I think that it was such an expensive time to fly to New York. I'd just gone freelance and Dale had lived there and, you know, knew it well and had lots of friends there. Let's just, you know, go and hang out for a month and stay and, you know, have adventures and see what happens. And at this wedding, and it was such a fun wedding because Mike and Anne, the couple, you know, that was the first time I'd met them and they were very, you know, sweet and welcoming and lovely about their friend bringing someone they'd never met, who had sort of played no role in their life. But it was just a sort of, it was a bit magical. It was in this sort of tiny, beautiful restaurant with a flowery courtyard and insanely great Italian food and this very sort of dramatic, romantic thunderstorm. We'd been dancing and Dale said something like, you know, oh, that was it. He said, I'm going to ask you to marry me, but, you know, I don't know when or not for a while. You kind of don't panic. But I remember that the way he phrased it being not, we're going to get married or I'm going to marry you, I'm going to ask you, which I thought was so, you know, sort of confident but humble. And then at the time I sort of blurted out something like, and I, you know, I think that's what I want. I'd love that. But also I said, like, I don't know how I feel about having kids. I'm not sure I want them. And the more we kept coming back to that, and there was something about the peace of finding him and knowing and realizing, I don't feel as though I want anything else. I have everything that I could, you know, want and love and dream of. And there's still some sort of ambiguity. But I think as well, I was raised Catholic, very Catholic, not just sort of Catholic in name, but, you know, genuinely like quite concerned about going to hell on a daily basis. You know, all of the very sort of complicated moral stuff about, you know, sex and sinning and which is definitely why I am so, and this is a word I always struggle with, prurient, sex obsessed in a vulgar way, because it was something that was so, you know, forbidden and thrilling and scary when I was growing up.
I'd not thought about how being from a religious background makes the prospect of babies and family different to me. Sorry, say more about that.
Well, I think because we were always such a gang, you know, and I've always felt I love.
You're one of how many?
28.
It's so many.
I mean, think how much lamb I have to roast when everyone comes around. So
yeah, having babies for you is like, this could go all the way to a football team.
My life is, you know, time and space and freedom. I mean, my God, now, you know, I'm a writer. I have very little in the way of like routine and obligation. And I think of myself as a profoundly, fundamentally selfish, lazy person, big Pisces. But actually I revel in that. And I look at what my mum, especially, and my dad, of course, but seeing her experience of motherhood and that it was so much about, you know, work and grind and sacrifice. And it's funny because my mum describes herself as lazy when she is the least lazy.
It's really funny you mention this because in the panic years when I was researching the book, women who had chosen to have children described themselves as incredibly selfish for doing this. I mean, like this, and me included. It's like, this is such a selfish act when we know the world is a very uncertain, scary place. To bring a child into it just because you want to have the sort of physical and emotional experience of motherhood is such a selfish act. And then women who, and men who had chosen not to have children would say, this is such a selfish thing. I'm an incredibly selfish person, and that's why I want to keep my life the way it is. And I have chosen these things above a possible, scary, dangerous future. We all feel like we're selfish. We all feel somehow judged for that decision. How did Dale react when you said, I'm really not sure about this?
Well, yeah, he sort of said, me too. And I think that's the thing. And what we kept going back to and going back to is, it's not even as though one of us is like, oh no, how, you know, I'd never think of that, you know, despite an obviously paranoid, lapsed Catholic, you know, I wear like 9 condoms across my whole body. But if I were to find myself pregnant, we'd have a a conversation, and it wouldn't be, you know, it'd be a shock. But I think that if there's anyone I'd want to do it with, it would be him. And it might be a, oh, we always thought this wasn't for us, but maybe the universe as it is, and maybe we want to trust the universe. But also because we were both so ambivalent, I think it would just take one person to be like, I really want this. And the other one would fall in, but no one wanted to lead the conversation.
So this wasn't you saying, I love you, darling, but I don't want to have children. It was more, I love you and darling, I might not want to have your babies.
I just think it's the most enormous life-altering thing you can do, and you have to be all in. And my two of my sisters, they've each got a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, all born within sort of a month of each other.
Wow.
And that was my big freak out, was when Penny was born and then Arthur was born. Within days of Penny being born, my granny, Peggy, died. And that feeling of, that's all right. I mean, she was 90, nearly 91. And, you know, she was awesome. Grannies are, aren't they? But she was smart and rude and funny. And she was a really extravagant complimenter. And she gave it up in later life, but a very good, really good at smoking, like better than Margot Tenenbaum. Great smoker.
My grandmother smoked John Player Specials, which Ooh. Are like, they're the cigarettes that like people in the Navy are like, oh, a bit strong for me. She'd be like, yes, babe. When she used to phone me on my student landline, there'd be someone would be like, there's like a weird old man on the phone for you. And I'd be like, hello, hello. Oh, it's my, hello, Nanu, how are you? So yeah, so that's a very a time of great upheaval, birth and death.
It was a double shunt. So one generation had come up and sort of pushed me up, and I wasn't the baby anymore, aged 32 I would have been, but still. And then losing that sort of, you know, the oldest generation as well. And also right around this time, my book How to Be a Grown-Up came out. And, you know, I fell apart, that I felt absolutely crushed by guilt for not wanting to have a baby, that, you know, Penny had brought so much joy to everyone. And I was, you know, looking at my book and thinking, this should be the absolute pinnacle. This is, you know, should be everything I've ever wanted. And I didn't feel validated. I didn't feel successful. I didn't feel legitimate. I didn't feel proper. And I was like, nothing I do will bring my parents as much joy and happiness as the production of a child. You know, if anyone else had had that conversation with me, I'd be like, well, God, no, of course, you know, not all people need to be mothers or fathers, and it's got to be a choice, and that's fine. I mean, aren't we lucky to live at a time when increasingly, while there's, you know, some stigma, it's easier, I think, than it's ever been to make that decision not to. But I was just so, it was like a grief then. I just felt so guilty for not wanting it. Like there was something broken. And, you know, it's got a lot easier now, I think. And I'm able to embrace, and I've got a lot better at really living my life. That sort of started a period of a low level, long kind of confusing depression, and I buried myself, and I was so binge eating and binge drinking. That sounds a lot more fun than it was, like I was at lampposts and, you know, but I was really able to sort of rotate my drugs of choice, and it was like I wasn't getting the same highs. When I was in my 20s, you know, I'd go out and drink my head off and then do all manner of like thrilling, stupid, cliched things. And all I do in my 30s, you know, sort of feeling like I'm sort of married and happy and it was normal, so I'd just go and like have a kebab and some cheesy chips.
More lamb. Jesus, Daisy. Come on.
It's going back to the lamb. And, you know, it's totally fine. Like every once in a while, of course, you know, you go out, you're in the pub, you miss dinner, you get chips. But I was doing that like 3 or 4 times a week, and I gained quite a lot of weight quite quickly. And it was only almost exactly 2 years ago when I started addressing that. And, you know, every so often I'd be like, oh, I'll do some like mad regime for a week or two, sort myself out, and then go. And also that the way I think it's all normalised, like, oh, we're all unhappy We're all spending huge amounts of money and we're all
trapped in a fleshy prison that we hate. I think that's sort of it, particularly for women. It's like, yeah, of course, that's the natural state of affairs. And so you just buy your way out of it. Thank you for sharing that description of grief, because it's so resonant and it's so powerful. And I think the thing that I long to sort of bring into a more public discourse is the fact that that grief is absolutely true and real and needs to be respected and cared for. And it doesn't undermine the stance that you take, that decision. It can be really hard to say, I want to have a baby. And it can be really hard to say, I don't want to have a baby. And the hardness doesn't mean that you're wrong. It just is hard. It's very hard to look into the face of a parent or a grandparent or a nephew or whoever and think, no, this isn't for me. And I think there's a sort of expectation, really unfairly, that people who choose to be child-free have to be happy about that all the time. Otherwise, they made the wrong decision. And it's so untrue. It also contributes to this relative expectation that is, people with children are expected to be happy about that decision all the time as well. And no one is. It's not a binary, you know, that it's a really complicated decision, and it's really emotional, and it taps into all of your greatest vulnerabilities. So of course you're going to have experience grief and joy and ambivalence and ambiguity when you go through it. It's absolutely a valid decision, even if it makes you cry to think about it.
That is, you know, really, really beautifully put and really resonant. And you know, I'd see my sisters, and I think sometimes it feels a little bit like the early years of the First World War. And, you know, they're saying that now, especially, that the fun and magic and the being present of it, that there's so little that you can predict or expect, you know, the parts that make their hearts sing, there's nothing that you could sort of really, really plan for. But at the same time, it's just, you know, pureed food in your eyebrows and their eyebrows and on the ceiling all day long. And the sort of, you know, painting the fourth bridge aspect of it.
And the crushing loneliness and fear and exhaustion and, you know, all of this. I'm not saying this to be like, you've done the right thing. I was really lonely and tired all the time. But I do think that side of it, while it remains taboo, makes child-free people sort of, I don't know, it seems like even more of an anomaly than it should be, to be like, but why don't you want to cuddle a baby and be happy? It's like, well, actually, because a lot of parenthood is awful and unrelenting, and it's actually quite a rational and emotionally sane decision to say, that's not my path.
I did want to say that my decision to sort of live differently and treat my body differently and myself differently, I was thinking, I guess, about, and I had that, and I'd started Insatiable, and I'd sort of, you know, been writing other books in the meantime. And I was thinking, I guess, about my sisters and what they, you know, and other mothers and what their days were full of, and me, and it was so easy. Oh, you know, I've got nothing going on. I'm selfish and lazy, and I'm not in an office, and I'm not being a mother. And I thought, well, I've got all of this time, and almost it made me realize I've sort of got no excuse to sort this out. Whatever happens in the future, that I do have time to really think about, you know, my days and my routine and how I want to live and feel in my body and be. And it was a real sort of, you know, centering time. And I'm not saying for a second that you need to do something else to prove that not being a parent is the right decision. I'm making air quotes there. But I realized, I suppose, more that taking a different path, I didn't have to obstruct the path of myself with fear and pain and shame, that I could use that other way as a gift. And, you know, it's the road less traveled. And I've tried to write about this, and I feel like there's more than one version of the story. And some days I'm just like, I wake up, I don't have an alarm. I love my life. I'm, you know, drinking coffee and reading in bed and listening to the sea and my culture. I choose good choices. And then sometimes it's, well, a lot of women choose motherhood and they tell their stories. And that's so wonderful and so important. Every single one of those stories is unique and deserves to be heard. Equally, you don't hear, I think, from as many women talking about not a mother. And I had a really interesting conversation with Jessie Burton on my podcast about this, to give that a plug. And we're talking about Sheila Hatey's motherhood and this idea of sort of being a mother versus not a mother. And that if all I do is, if I ever look back at my life and think, no, that was a mistake, everyone must have babies now, I'd be like, well, I don't mind being collateral. I don't mind being the science experiment.
That is magic. That's so magic. Now, Lambden are all round, I say. Thank you, Daisy, for such a revealing and heartfelt chat. What a champ. Now, at this point, I wanted to bring on an expert to dig into some of the topics that we discussed a little bit further. Simone Bowes is a counsellor for the UK's largest provider of relationship support, Relate, and also has her own private practice. My chat with Daisy showed just how intense our feelings around this question can be, and how we might struggle to talk to our loved ones, family, friends, partner, about it all. I asked Simone, just how often do people come to her to discuss whether or not they want children?
I'd say the majority of people, they see it as inevitable that they're going to have kids. When there are issues with that question, then that becomes a very big topic in the room because it has so much to do with the future of two individuals. They may have different values and they suddenly realise this when it comes to talking about having a child.
I sometimes thought of it as a sort of unstoppable force and an immovable object. What if one of you wants to have a family and the other one doesn't want to have a family? Where do you even start talking about that with each other?
I think it's important to understand why you feel the way that you do. Do that together as a kind of like a project, you know, write it down and then talk about it. You may find that you've got to sort of decide, do you want to continue with that person if it's a really important point and you're reaching an impasse on it?
Do you think, and this is a big question, do you think it's something that you should bring up as early as possible? Is it something that is worth bringing up when you're still dating? Or is it something that you should hold off and sort of see how things develop?
I think that if you are somebody that's very clear about it and it's something that you know in your mind and your heart, it's not going to change, then I would say it's important to say it earlier. Whereas if you're still in two minds, it's obviously something you could, you know, touch on in a very lighthearted way. I don't think you have to go too heavy on it, but it's good to tease it out and see, you know, what do you think about that? And, you know, get an idea of what the other person thinks.
So don't just leave a book of baby names in the loo. We're saying that's probably not.
No, but I think it's important to be straight. Well, you could do that. Yeah. Subtle hints everywhere.
I also wanted to talk to you about, I think particularly for women and people who, you know, have been brought up and identify as women, choosing not to have a child is still somewhat loaded. It's a decision that you will maybe feel judged upon, or that you need to explain to your family, or that it might put you in a minority among your peers. And I wondered, for the people that you see individually as well as in relationships, if you have any advice on that feeling. If you are someone who knows or suspects that you don't want to have children, how can you approach that in a way that is sort of healthy and constructive?
Counselling is such a good place to do this, actually, because you have the opportunity. Well, obviously, the counsellor themselves can ask these questions to you and get you to explore your ideas around having a child. Like, how do you imagine it being if you did have a child? How do you imagine your life if you didn't? Can you visualise your life and are you seeing it in the future? And also addressing that thing, do you really feel this, or is it because of society, or is it because of your friends around you, or is it because your parents, you know, always hinting at it and saying it, insinuating it, or that you feel that you might feel left out with your, you know, your friend, your peer group, because they're starting to have kids? And where are your narratives on having children? You know, did you watch movies romantically and think, I'm not going to be that perfect image, am I less than, you know, all these things. And I think then it's about feeling quite good about that, that you actually spent time exploring it, like you didn't blindly just not think about it or anything. Be happy that you did that. And then you can be more assertive about it. Then when you speak to people, you can be sure of yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like what you just said about the narratives about parenthood. You know, what narratives are you telling yourself about motherhood or about parenthood? And are they accurate? Are they fair? Are they based on reality? we're all telling ourselves a story, aren't we, about our lives and about our decisions and about our potential future. And maybe it's just a case of really analysing that narrative and seeing if it holds up and if it's fair and if it's representative, or if you're telling yourself an unhealthy or unhelpful story.
Yeah, it's about storytelling. Can you tell your story in a different way and still feel quite happy with it? There'll be losses either way. You may feel loss. You may feel it. If you don't, maybe sometimes you might feel like, oh, that child's so beautiful. Oh, you know, I wish I could experience this. But you might equally experience loss the other way, loss of all the adventure you might have had when you're completely free and, you know, you can do what you want and you've got extra money because you're not spending it on children. So I think it's also thinking about it like that, you know, that there's no exactly right answer or wrong answer. It's what's right for you.
Great. That's really great. If you're discussing whether you're going to have children or not, is there sort of language that you would particularly suggest not using, or that you would be very careful about using, things that maybe is open to interpretation in an unhelpful way? I think there's a sort of, that sometimes language can create problems as well as create communication. Are there things that you see in your work that you would guide people away from?
What happens is quite a lot of the time is that people can feel a little bit defensive and they have to justify, whereas you don't have to justify why you're having kids, but you always have to justify why you're not. And so sometimes your language can become quite defensive because you're sort of going, well, you know, I feel like, you know, I'll lose my independence. I'll lose the, because you might be talking to somebody who has a child or wants to have a child. So I suppose it's about thinking about the language you're using in the sense of it being flipped positively, perhaps. I have these goals that I have, and personalizing it, sort of respecting that other people like that choice and it can be great for them, you know, that it probably suits you. But for me, I feel like don't feel that way about being a mother, and it's very personal to me. And I have these things that I would really like to do with my specific life that for me, I feel like I would miss out on, you know. So it's not generalizing something.
That's such a good point, that if you make it personal to you and positive to your situation, that then is much less likely to be seen as an attack on the person you're talking to or a criticism of their feelings. You know, if you're talking about yourself and you're talking about your individual circumstance and just your personal sort of perspective, even if that is opposite to the person you're talking to, they can't feel judged, or they hopefully won't feel judged by your own feelings, because your feelings are your feelings. That is, like, I think if I could go into every interaction with a sort of openness, but also honesty about my feelings, wouldn't it be easier? Wouldn't life be better? So if we are going to do the work to sort of deconstruct our feelings in order to present them better to the person that either we're in that relationship with, whether they are our partner or a friend or family member, do you have any practical advice on how you can go about that?
I think a visualization is really important, like being able to see yourself and maybe write out a picture of yourself without a child. Like, what would you be doing? What do you see yourself planning in your life? And then doing the same with having a baby. How do you see yourself being?
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast as much as I enjoyed making it. Thank you hugely to Daisy and Simone for being part of it, and to you for making it all the way to the end. I like you very much. Next week on the podcast, I'll be talking to the comedian Sarah Pascoe about why we hate weddings. If you've enjoyed this episode of The Panic Years, and actually even if you haven't, I would be thrilled if you could subscribe and leave a lovely review to help other people find it. Thank you, and see you next week.
This is a brand new audio production.